I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. President Obama and Governor Romney don't like each other very much. That was pretty obvious early on last night at the second presidential debate where the candidates took questions from an audience of undecided voters. It was moderated by CNN's Candy Crowley. Governor Romney kept his focus on the president's four-year record in office and the rate of unemployment.
Well, what you're seeing in this country is 23 million people struggling to find a job. And a lot of them, as you say, Candy, have been out of work for a long, long, long time. The president's policies have been exercised over the last 4 years, and they haven't put Americans back to work. We have fewer people working today than we had when the president took office. If the unemployment rate was 7.8% when he took office, it's 7.8% now. But if you calculated that unemployment rate, taking back the people who dropped out of the workforce, it would be 10.7%. We have not made the progress we need to make to put people back to work. That's why I put out a five-point plan that gets America 12 million new jobs in 4 years and rising take-home pay. It's going to help Jeremy get a job when he comes out of school. It's going to help people across the country that are unemployed right now.
President Obama quickly responded by criticizing Romney's plan for economic recovery.
Now, Governor Romney says he's got a five-point plan. Governor Romney doesn't have a five-point plan. He has a one-point plan. And that plan is to make sure that folks at the top play by a different set of rules. That's been his philosophy in the private sector. That's been his philosophy as governor. That's been his philosophy as a presidential candidate. You can make a lot of money and pay lower tax rates than somebody who makes a lot less. You can ship jobs overseas and get tax breaks for it. You can invest in a company, bankrupt it, lay off the workers, strip away their pensions, and you still make money. That's exactly the philosophy that we've seen in place for the last decade. That's what's been squeezing middle-class families. And we have fought back for 4 years to get out of that mess. The last thing we need to do is to go back to the very same policies that got us there.
The candidates sparred over a wide range of domestic issues and the attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya, that killed four Americans, including the U.S. ambassador. We have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Tom Farrick, senior editor of Metropolis. That's a local news and information site based in Philadelphia. Prior to Metropolis, he worked as a reporter, editor, and columnist with the Philadelphia Inquirer. And Tom Farrick, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Glad to be here.
Also with us is Ben Berger, associate professor of political science at Swarthmore College, where he teaches about the theory and practice of democratic politics, including citizen participation, civic engagement, and ethics in politics. Wrote a book called Attention Deficit Democracy. And Ben Berger, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Always a lot of fun, Marty.
A lot of fun for us as well. And it was a very, I would say, fun evening last night. And Ben, looking at this town hall style debate, did that work from your perspective?
It works because it does have a more personable feel than some other kinds of style of debate. I think it's good for the candidates also to be able to stroll around a little bit and interact with people. I think it was good for Obama to be able to show kind of this human, more human side than he did. He was able to relax a little bit and come out of a shell from the first debate. So I always like it the most of all the debate formats.
How about for you, Tom? You like that format?
I did like the format, and I like the fact that it was much more interesting, I think, this time because the president showed up. And last time he was sort of AWOL, at least intellectually or as a physical presence. So it was good to see him back on his game. We refer to it as a game. It's not a game at all. I was kind of struck by the fact that, we reporters always have our kit bag of sports metaphors that we open up. And they opened up theirs last night and they poured out all the boxing ones because I got headlines like punch and counter, punch sparring, feisty, testy, tense. And I said before that had you not watched the debate, picked up the paper that morning, you would have thought they came to blows. But they didn't, obviously. But it was that kind of competition, though. And I find inherently interesting. There was lots of conflict. There was lots of disagreement. They were both good and informed. So what's the complaint?
Yeah, it's a real debate. But I always find those town hall style debates interesting as well, just because of how you see the candidates move around the stage, how close they get to each other's personal space, as we call it. Tom, did anything jump out at you?
Well, there was. I mean, you said that they don't like each other. And I think that came through with the body language. And I think it's their obligation as candidates to sort of put on a neutral, generally pleasant face during the whole thing, not to roll their eyes, not to stick their tongue out, and they both succeeded in doing that. But there was a time there when they sort of started to come together, and it was like, you are in my space.
Exactly.
Get away from my space. And I think both of them did it.
Yeah.
So they were pulled back by Candy Crowley, in essence, by moving on with the next question.
What did you see, Ben, in terms of, I guess, just the body language?
I thought they actually were going to come to blows a few times. And I think some of the observers there, people in the audience, said that afterwards. There seemed to be that. It was Al Gore, I think, in 2000, got so close to George Bush that Bush said he was up in my chili. And they were each in each other's chilies last night. And so I think, yeah, the dislike came through. But it was there was energy to it and a kind of real quality. They shouldn't be loving each other right now. And I think that's all right.
And is it okay to be up in someone's chili when you're debating about the future of the country?
If both, especially if both people are doing it. Because it hadn't been done before when Gore did it, it took a lot of people by surprise and kind of was alarming. It seemed like he was off to assault the president or the person running for president. But I think especially when both people are in there and agreeing to it, it is like a boxing match, and that's good.
But you know what's interesting? There was this commission on debates, and they came up with all these rules that the candidates were supposed to follow and rules that apparently or allegedly the moderator was supposed to follow as well. But it seems, Tom, that those rules were broken pretty often and early in this debate.
They were, and Candy Crowley's job was to sort of hold it together while keeping it moving. And I think she realized that if she just let go a little, either one of them would have talked for another 6 minutes and not yielded the floor. So I was glad that she stopped that. There's also following a rule that all politicians fulfill. If they get a question they don't like, yes, they just answer another question.
I've noticed that, yes, over my 25 years on the air, yes.
Yes. If you ask them about their position on abortion, they're going to talk about a recipe for fried chicken if they don't want to take a position. And that was evident last night as well.
Yeah. What about for you, Ben?
That happened a few times last night. And actually, if you go by the undecided voters who were rating this moment to moment, second to second, I think that the lowest point for each of the candidates came when they were dodging a question. When Obama started talking about teachers instead of assault weapons, and when Romney started talking about the pension plan instead of whatever he was being asked about. People reacted negatively to that. And Crowley did a good job, I think, of trying to pull them back.
We were talking actually before the show began about undecided voters. Let me toss this back to you, Ben Berger. Do you think we fetishize undecided voters too much?
That's exactly the word I would use to describe it. It's not a crime to be an undecided voter, and it's not a crime also to not pay attention or to not vote. But voters who haven't made up their mind over a period of seeing Obama for about 4 years and Romney for over a year with the primaries, I don't think they should be publicly shamed and put in the stockades, but they shouldn't be publicly honored either. And that's what's happening. They're given a lot of say on the airwaves.
But are you saying that it was a mistake last night to have the audience full of undecided voters?
I think it is a mistake. I think – and it's not just the – so they got to ask the questions, and there's a particular kind of question that's going to be asked by somebody who doesn't feel that they've had enough information thus far. But there's also what I really dislike, but I was saying to you before, I can't look away. It's like a train wreck, is this rating system that they had, that CNN does with undecided voters, 35 of them in a room, and they do a second-to-second rating, and they put it up on the screen the entire time. So it's like an emotional stock ticker, and it frames the entire debate. So the lens that frames the debate is not one that's put out by people who are sagacious, but it's those who haven't even made up their minds yet.
What do you think, Tom?
Well, the reality of politics is that there are what they call late engagers, people who do not pay any attention to it until the very end. There are people in America who pay no attention to baseball until the World Series comes on. And I guess that's the analogy. And these are people who have not made up their mind. And for better or for worse, in a race where everybody's sort of 48-48, that 4% is going to make a difference. Mm. Now, I find that among them tend to be the cognitively challenged. That's a polite word.
Well, some call them low information voters.
Yeah, idiots. But
did you just say idiots?
I did. I said idiots.
You called them idiots?
No, I called them they're cognitively challenged. So you're trying to get the attention of people who have not paid attention, are in a bubble, don't particularly care about public affairs. And I think that let's forget the idiot thing, but let's say the low engagement.
I haven't, but
okay.
Go ahead.
All right. That's what helped Romney in the first debate. Because Romney, first of all, to everyone else who watched it, thought He's a moderate today. He's been a conservative for the last 9 months. He's against repealing Dodd-Frank. He was before. He's against repealing Obamacare. He was promising to do it before. And everybody was noticing how quickly he shapeshifted into a moderate. Well, if you're just tuning in the first time, you could nod your head and say, well, that guy sounds okay. And I think that's what his performance was aimed at and has been aimed at from the very beginning. He's certainly not talking to his Republican base because he's saying things that would have infuriated them during the primary. He's out after that little sliver of voter.
Are they idiots, Ben?
Chris Matthews used the somewhat more polite term of boneheads.
Okay, I'll
so you're
that.
On the same page with Chris Matthews. Right. I wouldn't go and blame so much the voters. There's an old line from The Simpsons when Kent Brockman, the anchorman, is asked about the declining economy. And he says, at the risk of sounding being unpopular, I want to place the blame squarely on you, the viewers. I don't want to blame these particular viewers, but I do want to blame the media and the campaigns that try to elevate them so much. The best example of the reason, it's not that I disagree with any one of their feelings. It's that they tend to have some cognitive dissonance. These are people who, when asked beforehand, say they want more information. They haven't gotten enough. And they want a better way of differentiating between the candidates, but they consistently rate the candidates lower the minute the candidate starts saying something negative about the other one. But of course, part of differentiating yourself is going to be saying something negative. So there's that cognitive dissonance that I would not like to see highlighted.
You can always quote The Simpsons on Radio Times. I just want you to know that, Ben. But we have fact checkers now. I mean, it's and sometimes you can do it in real time, although that's, I think, harder.
Yeah.
I have a bunch of fact check information spread out on the table here. It is possible to fact check what the candidates say.
Oh, yeah, it's possible and it's done. And there are organizations doing it more today than they ever were, which is great, as opposed to taking things at face value. But it tends to be overwhelmed by the paid media that the candidates and their PAC supporters are buying in the home states. And I think it's become a matter of macho pride for some of the campaign consultants to say, fact check? We don't need to worry about fact check. We can just be more outrageous than we ever have been. And that's a shame, but that's the reality. So that sort of gets drowned out. And I don't think these are the type of voters, they're recumbent voters. They're not going to go around to factcheck.org or all to the various places and sort of parse this in detail to find out what's going on. Their exposure to that will be either through the ads of, let's say, Obama to counter something that Romney did, or something in his debates where one candidate says, oh, no, that's not true. Here's the facts.
We're almost having a break here, but do you think ads trump fact-checking organizations?
Sure, and inattention trumps it also, because the people who are going to be paying attention to the debate after the debate are the ones who are most informed anyhow. And the ones who aren't, who are just checking in for a little while in the debate, they're the ones who aren't paying attention once the debate is over.
Well, we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. We have more clips as well from last night's presidential debate between President Obama and Governor Romney. Talking with Ben Berger, associate professor of political science at Swarthmore College, wrote a book called Attention Deficit Democracy. Also with us is Tom Farrick, senior editor of Metropolis. That's a local news and information site based here in Philadelphia. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. If you watched last night's debate, we know that millions did. What did you think? Give us a call. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Live Nation is proud to support WHYY. February 16th, international singer Sarah Brightman comes to the Tower Theater. Tickets and information online at livenation.com and thetowerphilly.com.
Holy Family University supports WHYY and is offering a graduate open house on Wednesday, October 17th from 5 to 6:30 p.m. at the university's Woodhaven site. It is an opportunity to learn more about Holy Family's graduate programs in education, counseling psychology, criminal justice, business, nursing, and accelerated MBAs, all designed specifically to help balance school with work and life. Now is the time to apply for a January start. Details at holyfamily.edu/YOU.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're in the middle of the fall membership campaign here at WHYY when we remind you that your support is vital to the health and future of WHYY. You're listening to our discussion of last night's presidential debate because you appreciate our in-depth conversations on Radio Times. Make a pledge of $60 and receive our brand new Radio Times 25th anniversary mug designed by Tony Auth. Call 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online at WHYY.org. Thanks.
Support for WHYY comes from PNC Wealth Management, helping customers live achievement by crafting personalized solutions to grow, preserve, and transfer wealth. More information is available from John Conaway at 215-585-5438.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Tom Farrick and also talking with Ben Berger about last night's presidential debate. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me play two more clips from last night's debate. The candidates disagreed over tax policy, with Governor Romney saying he wants to bring the rates down. Let's listen.
If somebody came to you, Governor, with a plan that said, here, I want to spend $7 or $8 trillion, and we're going to pay for it, but we can't tell you until maybe after the election how we're going to do it, you wouldn't have taken such a sketchy deal. And neither should you, the American people, because the math doesn't add up.
That actually was President Obama, who had originally praised Romney's success as an investor and then criticized him. Let's listen to what Governor Romney had to say. No.
You're absolutely right. You heard what I said about my tax plan. The top 5% will continue to pay 60% as they do today. I'm not looking to cut taxes for wealthy people. I am looking to cut taxes for middle-income people. And why do I want to bring rates down and at the same time lower exemptions and deductions, particularly for people at the high end? Because if you bring rates down, it makes it easier for small business to keep more of their capital and hire people. And for me, this is about jobs. I want to get America's economy going again.
And obviously, a lot of discussion from Governor Romney about jobs, especially small business. Also, a lot of the focus last night was on women. I'm not sure how many times, Tom, that the president mentioned Planned Parenthood, but obviously targeting that prized representative or member of the electorate, women.
Well, there's a feeling that his weak spot right now is among women voters. I don't see evidence in Pennsylvania, but there have been polls, and you can always cite polls, that have showed an erosion of that support. And I think those are attempts to sort of get that back by touching on those themes as he went along, even though there were light touches on the theme and he had to bring it up. It's not the kind of issue that Romney would bring up. Mm-hmm. It's because his position is antithetical to a lot of women. But it is a thing that I think it's fair for the president to bring up. He did a good job this time of bringing up issues that set them off and sort of turning it back on Romney.
Looking at the woman vote, or how do you see that, Ben?
I can't think about the woman vote and the comments last night without mentioning this instant meme, which is all over the web right now, of binders full of women. Mm-hmm. That this rather bizarre characterization by Romney trying to get across his pro-woman gender equality orientation. Now, I've read reports that strongly contest Romney's version, that say that in 2002 there was a bipartisan group of Massachusetts women who formed this group called MassGap to address the problem of there not being enough qualified women in positions like the ones that Romney was talking about. So they assembled this binder full of women, although I think they probably had the good sense not to make it sound like a mail order bride catalog. But then they presented it to Romney after he won. So that's how it happened. But even if he really had gone and tried to engineer a study, it's odd to me that somebody who had been in business for as long as he had been wouldn't have known a bunch of qualified women would need to go and look to outside support. I mean, unless he's spending all his time at Augusta National Golf Club, What's going on?
But you're saying even the phrase binder full of women, that phrase will haunt Governor Romney?
It is. It immediately started trending. If you pay attention to these things on Twitter and Facebook, there are tons now of images that have been generated with that, comedic images that are sort of making fun of him for that. I absolutely think that's going to be one of the moments that some years from now, when they assemble clips from defining moments, it doesn't mean that he'll win or lose, right, but I do think it's going to be a defining moment for him.
Those couple words, Tom.
Well, I don't
can
know.
Make or break a candidate.
I mean, I these things go up. You know, there used to be a trajectory for issues like this, and they would be like a day or two. And then they'd sort of arc, and then something else would come up because we're very close to the election. Now it seems we're down to nanoseconds. I'm not sure that there's not something that 2 o'clock in the afternoon is going to replace the binding of women among the commentariat and the blogs and stuff like that as people probe into this. And suddenly it will sink beneath the waves. It's hard to tell these days. I don't think it's substantive enough. It's not like a tremendous gaffe. I don't think it's substantive enough to have legs, as they say.
Do you think it's the equivalent of Gore sighing? I mean, you know, I realize that that was a different time and place and obviously a different candidate. But that seemed to haunt Gore.
Yeah, I don't think it's quite that. I mean, that's like, this is a slip of the tongue. This is, although you could say it betrays an attitude, but it is a slip of the tongue. I don't think it's a sign that he's not interested or that he, I still don't see that much in it. Sorry.
The one little thing I want to add is it could conceivably, though, become a little more like George H.W. Bush with the price scanner, of showing it being out of touch,
right.
An attitude of, well, this is what it took for me to get in touch with women or try to put women in the proper positions.
Yeah. And what do you think by saying the words Planned Parenthood, what do you think that the president was telegraphing there, Tom? Then we'll get to our callers.
Well, that was sort of like he wanted to mention the fact that this Republican ticket is hostile to the traditional women's abortion rights issues. And there's no doubt that
it
is.
Or even contraception.
And contraception as well. And the question wasn't about contraception, so it was about budget cutting. And he mentioned Big Bird, who I saw his patron saint picture out here, and Planned Parenthood. Great symbolic stand-ins for the kind of things that he wants the point to get out.
Yeah, you agree, Big Bird and Planned Parenthood, Ben, and then we'll get to our callers.
Yeah, those they go together.
Yeah,
like apple pie and something.
And something.
Bird feed.
Exactly. Ben Berger, Tom Farrick, our guest today on Radio Times. And we are deconstructing, analyzing last night's presidential debate. Full bank of calls here. Let's see what Jack from Center City, Philadelphia has to say. And Jack, go ahead. You're on the air.
I'm trying to connect the dots on the Romney tax plan. Yesterday, what he said was that the wealthy would pay the same share, 60%. He didn't say they'd pay the same amount. I'm trying to figure out what that means and whether the total tax bill is going down or up. Paul Ryan said the revenue was going to be revenue neutral, which I presume means that including the growth that's always projected with tax cuts, the revenue would stay the same. But if that's the case, then where is the payment to the debt? So I'm just confused about what. In this vague references that they make, how do you interpret what this tax plan is and how they're offsetting the revenue loss from 20% cut in rates?
Well, Jack, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. So let me just quote Governor Romney. You heard what I said about my tax plan. The top 5% will continue to pay 60% as they do today. I'm not looking to cut taxes for wealthy people. I'm looking to cut taxes for middle-income people. Neither of our guests are economists, but this issue about Tom, his tax plan, and it's been vetted by a number of organizations and looking like the numbers don't exactly add up.
Well, they don't add up because we can't figure out what it is. The charge that he set these broad goals but has not been specific about how he's going to do it is legitimate criticism. And the analysts at the various think tanks down in Washington can do this, but they need the factors. And he has refused to step up. He said, for instance, that we're going to lower the rate 20% for everybody, and we're going to get rid of certain deductions. And he hasn't said what those deductions are. Now, if you look at a list of the big cost deductions, in other words, the ones you'd have to go after, seems to me, there's like a dozen, and one of them is the mortgage deduction, one of them is the 401k deduction, one of them is the biggest one is the deduction that employers can take for the cost of offering health care to their employees. Those are the big ones. The charitable deductions are another one. You can't close business loopholes, for instance, I mean you can, and raise the kind of money they're going to have to get in order to make this revenue neutral. It just doesn't seem to add up, but we don't know the particulars. Now, last night, he did get a little bit more specific. He said the one way we could offset the proposed 20% income tax rates would be to create a new cap on deductions, suggesting $25,000 as a possible limit,
right.
Meaning the taxpayers would aggregate their mortgage interest, charitable deductions, and other deductions up to that point. And if it was more, you couldn't take it. And if it was less, you got to get the 25. Now, since this is all about me, I went and looked through my tax return today and saw that when you add up my charitable, all my deductions, state and local taxes, charitable, mortgage, real estate, last year it came to $27,000. But I have a question for Mr. Romney. I also have a business, and I was able to deduct $33,000 in business expenses. Would that go out the window under this plan? I mean, I just don't know the answer to that.
Well, specificity, I guess, matters, but it can come with a cost or a price.
That's right. The more you stay loose with these things, the better they are to sell. He's able to say, at least I've got a 5-point plan. And the criticism of Obama has been that he hasn't articulated what he's going to do. The particulars, actually, of Romney's 5 points are really not much more specific than anything Obama has done or might claim to do, but he can frame it in that way. I just want to point out, too, that the interesting thing that not so many commentators talked about with the 5% and 60% is that the 5% control more than 60% of the wealth.
Right.
And that's increased a lot over recent years. And so that's got to be somewhat controversial, but Romney doesn't acknowledge it.
Let me see what looks like Karina from Allentown has to say. Karina, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that this debate was absolutely amazing to watch. I really did think that they were going to take it outside and, you know, duke it out. But, you know, my husband's a stay-at-home dad. He has his business at home, and I am the one that actually goes out on the field to work. And for me, it was quite offensive to hear that Romney's biggest concern was not that I have equal pay like my male counterparts, but rather that I actually am home in time to make dinner, and I'm surprised he didn't add an apple pie, for example. So that to me was extremely offensive, and if ever I thought that he was out of touch, this really is what sealed the deal for me.
Oh, that's interesting. Karina, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Ben, she didn't like the way he talked about coming home and making dinner.
I didn't much like it either, and Obama had exactly the counterpoint of saying that a big reason for caring is not just equity, about gender equity, but also the fact that women are increasingly breadwinners. And so it's not just equity for them, although that's part of it, but it's also good for the country to get more equal pay for equal work.
Yeah. Let me ask you, Tom, whether you think the questions were dramatically different coming from regular people versus journalists. Do regular people ask and are interested in different things than, let's say, the Beltway journalists, which tend to be the ones that we hear about?
You get two types of questions that I've discovered over the years from these events. One of them is sort of this general, gosh, the country's doing bad. What can you do to improve the economy type question, which doesn't, you know, at least sets the topic. But some of them come out of left field. That thing about George Bush. What would you have done differently than George Bush? Let them do it. That came totally out of left field. Mm-hmm. You could always get one that comes out, you know, and you're there as a candidate. And I think you've got to go, God, I wasn't prepared for that. And they have to sort of step back and answer it. Romney did, but he also answered it in a way that opened him up to a criticism by the president.
What do you think, Ben?
It was interesting that each candidate tried to portray the other one as too much like George Bush. Obama, of course, tried to say that Romney's like Bush, but more socially conservative on social issues. But Romney said that, well, Obama said he was going to change the deficit and improve the deficit, but actually he only made it much worse.
Yeah. In fact, let me play that little interchange. And this is Governor Romney, as we were saying, was asked about how he differed from President Bush. After he answered the question from the audience, President Obama said this.
But the last point I want to make is this. You know, there are some things where Governor Romney is different from George Bush. You know, George Bush didn't propose turning Medicare into a voucher. George Bush embraced comprehensive immigration reform. He didn't call for self-deportation. George Bush never suggested that we eliminate funding for Planned Parenthood. So there are differences between Governor Romney and George Bush, but they're not on economic policy. In some ways, he's gone to a more extreme place when it comes to social policy. And I think that's a mistake. That's not how we're going to move our economy forward.
And later, Mitt Romney used how President Reagan handled his recession against the president.
You might say, well, you got an example of when it worked better? Yeah. In the Reagan recession, where unemployment hit 10.8%, between that period, the end of that recession, and equivalent period of time to today, Ronald Reagan's recovery created twice as many jobs as this president's recovery. 5 million jobs doesn't even keep up with our population growth. And the only reason the unemployment rate seems a little lower today is because of all the people that have dropped out of the workforce. The president has tried, but his policies haven't worked. He's great as a speaker and describing his plans and his vision. That's wonderful, except we have a record to look at.
Was that effective, Tom, what Governor Romney just said?
I think it was. Let me mention one thing historically. Ronald Reagan did increase taxes when he came into office in order to deal with those economic issues. It's interesting he uses the analogy with Reagan because I use the same thing with Romney. And I take it back to 80 when Jimmy Carter was president and unpopular. We had high unemployment. We had inflation. We had the Iranian situation. We were in line for gas. And there was a feeling he was not a good leader. But people were concerned about Ronald Reagan because they saw him as a hardline, conservative, bellicose guy, California governor, who they just didn't think they would like. They had one debate during that period, and it was a week before the election, I think. And what happened was is that Reagan came across as affable, intelligent, a likable guy. Those feelings diminished because of that debate. And I know in Pennsylvania at the time, because I was covering the presidential campaign in Pennsylvania at that time, that debate changed within a pattern, like over the weekend.
Wow.
It was everybody's made a decision, said, well, he's an okay alternative. I really didn't like Carter. I'm going to go with this guy, Reagan. I'll take a chance. And it switched over that weekend. I think what Romney has done, and is most powerfully, is in the first debate, and also reinforced in this one, is his basic elevator speech, which he's got down. He's a nice guy, Obama. We gave him 4 years to try to do it. He failed. It's time to give someone else a chance to improve the economy and deal with the issue of taxes and unemployment, and I'm the guy to do that. And I think he has succeeded in delivering that message. And I think that's why we're seeing the numbers change.
Oh, that's interesting. And the numbers are in flux, I would say, and we don't know what the numbers from last night will be or not. Ben Berger, your thoughts about Ronald Reagan? And I've always believed, maybe because I'm a radio person, that he has or had a beautiful voice. Just a beautiful voice to actually listen to.
Well, as a native Chicagoan and a Cubs fan, I'll note that Reagan was, I believe, a radio announcer for the Cubs for a while. So that puts his voice in good stead with me, even if I didn't agree with everything else that he said. Right. I think it's a great comparison. It's certainly one that Romney wants to see happen. If it goes in the direction of Romney winning, I mean, it absolutely could happen, then this will seem like a repeat, for sure, of Obama as an embattled first-term president who has a wonkish side, which doesn't always come out well in debates, and people looking for some kind of other alternative and it coming through. I don't think Romney is as charming as Reagan was, but I think that the Obama people hope much more that Romney can be cast as Barry Goldwater. And Romney used the extremist line in the clip that you just played there. They want to push that home, that actually he's really socially extreme and it's not just this moderate guy.
That's Ben Berger, Associate Professor of Political Science at Swarthmore College. Also with us is Tom Farrick. He's Senior Editor of Metropolis. We're talking about last night's presidential debate. Just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. One more clip to play as well. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The University of Pennsylvania supports WHYY. Are you drinking more than you want to? Would you like to reduce your drinking? UPenn is conducting a 13-week research study of a medication to help people reduce their drinking. To participate, you must be 18 to 65 and a regular drinker. The study provides a medical evaluation, including blood tests, brief counseling, and monitoring of your drinking. Details at 215-222-3200, extension 241. 215-222-3200, extension 241.
I'm Marty Moscoen. We're in the middle of the fall membership campaign here at WHYY when we remind you that your support is vital to the health and future of WHYY. You're listening to our discussion of last night's presidential debate because you appreciate our in-depth conversations on Radio Times. Make a pledge of $60 and receive our brand new Radio Times 25th anniversary mug designed by Tony Auth. Call 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online at WHYY.org. Thanks.
Supporting WHYY, Philadelphia Theater Company, presenting the world premiere musical Stars of David, a snapshot of Jewish identity told through interviews with some of America's public figures, including Gloria Steinem, Leonard Nimoy, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Aaron Sorkin, and Joan Rivers. Based on the best-selling book Stars of David, featuring original music by composers and lyricists of Broadway shows such as A Chorus Line, Fiddler on the Roof, Hairspray, and Spring Awakening. Stars of David runs October 17th through November 18th. Tickets available at PhiladelphiaTheaterCompany.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Tom Farrick and Ben Berger about last night's presidential debate. Let's see what Roger from Winfield has to say. And Roger, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I'd just like to go back to the beginning of the show and say that I find it really disheartening to hear folks in the media say that undecided voters are boneheads or idiots or something like that. People are looking for information. They're not looking for comments on Ronald Reagan's voice or opinions. They're looking for information. It's hard to come by. And comments like that, if I want to hear that, I can go to Fox. That's what they live for.
Well, Roger, let me just stop you there. Why are you saying that information is hard to come by? You've got the campaigns, you have websites, you've got newspapers, you've got radio shows, you've got TV shows. We are inundated with information.
We're inundated with comments and opinions. Information. Jack was asking earlier, the caller was asking about tax deductions. And granted, your guests are not economists. They said that. However, who's got that information? Well, if the candidates don't have it, you can go to every website you want. If someone takes a position on that, you know, they're reticent to do that because they'll get attacked with boatloads of misinformation. And it's very hard to find facts. Opinions are everywhere. I have an opinion.
Well, I think there's information and there is misinformation. And the tricky part and sometimes the difficult part is figuring out what those two, how they are different and where to find them. But let me give Tom Farrick a chance to respond because, Tom, you're the one that said it.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I think there is a place to find that information, not simply opinions. I agree there's just a lot of opinions out there. Tend to be partisan, one way or the other. Factcheck.org. Takes every fact it is asserted by the candidates and analyzes them and looks up the record. And there's another fact check that's a cousin of it.
PolitiFact?
Yeah, PolitiFact, that takes each statement and does it. The Congressional Budget Office, which we think of wouldn't do this, has a great website that talks about financial needs and talks. It's where the information I got about the cost of deductions and things like that. If someone and I think they're also inclined to try to do an analysis of, say, the Romney plan. And I think they have failed to do the analysis because they didn't have the necessary facts. When you look at those organizations, you can come away with a conclusion that we don't have the facts we need to make an analysis of this tax plan. That's not true of all his statements, by the way. But those are two sources right there, and there are a lot of good sources on the web. The question is sorting out which ones are the
sure.
good ones and which ones are bogus.
Sure.
That you can now, as a citizen, as opposed to 25 years ago, be able to sit down and draw your own conclusions and opinions based upon the facts.
Go ahead, Ben Berger.
Right. There is a lot of supply, and the issue is more often demand for the information. It's not the case that in the old Field of Dreams model, build it and they will come. Mm-hmm. Information is out there. I do think that there are some of the undecided voters there last night asked perfectly intelligent questions, and they seemed like reasonable people. So, again, my take isn't there's an understandable thing. I think if you're in the business of covering the news and trying to make it understandable and so on, to be frustrated with those who don't want to – who decide either not to seek it out or have taken a real long time to get that information. My main complaint is about the raising, the honoring of the undecided, not simply the fact that they're undecided.
And Roger, I should say that I printed out from Fact Check their analysis of last night's debate. I have it right here. Same thing with PolitiFact. So it is possible, maybe not in real time, but certainly in near time, to get some analysis of what was said last night. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me get Francis from Coatesville, and then we'll play another clip. And Francis, go ahead.
Hi. Just want to say I thought it was a great debate. Two really smart men, and both are really impressive. I don't think any of us could have done what they did last night. I want to ask Ben and Tom to be fortune tellers. We desperately need bipartisan solutions to so many problems that our country is facing come January. What are the chances that if Obama is reelected and we still have a Republican House, what are the chances that we're going to be able to come to some of those bipartisan solutions?
Well, Francis, I'm actually going to toss that to Ben Berger, knowing that how difficult it is to predict things. But if past is prologue, what do you think?
Extremely unlikely. That is to say that things get done. We don't live in a parliamentary system. Parliamentary system is designed for the winning party to build a government and then push through platforms. And one of the things that our system has built into it is gridlock. It's supposed to make it hard for things to get done, but that's extremely frustrating a lot of the time. I think it's extremely unlikely. The issue is that it's even though Obama will be in his second term, and then Republicans will not be able to achieve the aim of getting him out as soon as possible, which was the espoused claim in his first term. They'll then be focusing on the next term. They'll want to say, well, you know, if we can then make sure nothing really gets done, then Hillary will go down in 2016, assuming she's the candidate, and maybe another cycle after that as well.
Mm. As you look into your crystal ball, Tom, what do you see?
I left that at home. I usually bring it here, and I apologize for that. Sometimes it's murky. I have to clean it.
Is it murky now?
No, it's actually quite clear based upon previous experience. If Obama was going to win this election by 7 points, he is likely to have pulled up Democratic candidates for Congress and Senate with him. But a recent story told me that the Democrats in the suburban Philadelphia have pulled their money out for the Democrats who are running against Republicans there for Congress. And that's a sign they feel they can't get it. If you're going to end up winning by 2 points, you're not going to be able to do that. You're going to have a Republican Congress. And the Republican Congress will immediately begin to look towards 2016. And want to frame the issues based upon that. So I hate to say this, but I think that you're not going to see any flowering of bipartisanship over the next 4 years. It's just back to the trenches.
Francis, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Talking about last night's presidential debate, let me play one more clip. And there was a question near the end of the debate about Libya and the attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi. The president took offense at Governor Romney's charge that his administration was playing politics with this tragedy. Here's what happened next.
And the suggestion that anybody in my team, whether the Secretary of State, our UN ambassador, anybody on my team would play politics or mislead when we've lost four of our own, Governor, is offensive. That's not what we do. That's not what I do as president. That's not what I do as commander-in-chief.
Governor, if you want to reply quickly, I
think it's interesting. The president just said something which is that on the day after the attack, he went to the Rose Garden and said that this was an act of terror.
That's what I said.
You said in the Rose Garden, the day after the attack, it was an act of terror. It was not a spontaneous demonstration. Is that what you're saying?
Please proceed, Governor.
I want to make sure we get that for the record, because it took the president 14 days before he called the attack in Benghazi an act of terror.
Get the transcript.
He did, in fact, sir. So let me call it an act of terror.
Can you say that a little louder, Candy?
He did call it an act of terror. It did as well take 2 weeks or so for the whole idea of there being a riot out there about this tape to come out. You're correct
this,
about that.
The administration indicated that this was a reaction to a video and was a spontaneous reaction.
They did.
It took them a long time to say this was a terrorist act by a terrorist group. And to suggest, am I incorrect in that regard?
Ben, was this an important interchange? It was near the end of the debate.
It's important. and confusing to a lot of people, and it's being endlessly debated right now, and it will be continue to be debated for a while. I actually was a little bit dismayed by Crowley's intervention there. I think she's really smart. I like her as a moderator generally, but I thought, especially as the debate went on, that she started to insinuate herself too much into the whole thing. So if I were a Romney supporter, I'd be pretty ticked off, and I think that they are, in fact. So she did fact-checking on the spot, and it turned out that she sort of had it right, but kind of not. It could have gone either way. That in his Rose Garden comments, Obama actually said he used the term acts of terror, but he didn't specifically call the Benghazi thing that. He closely implied, strongly implied that it was, because right afterwards he said that we have four more dead people after talking about acts of terror. But if you look at that that transcript, you see it's not exactly clear. But she jumped in and said, "You are wrong, Governor Romney," essentially. And that scores points. And then she turned around and said, "Well, also, of course, Romney was sort of right in the larger picture." I just don't think that's exactly the moderator's place.
What do you think, Tom? Did she overstep her authority?
No, I didn't. I wasn't offended by that. I figured everybody would have time to sort it out. I was struck by the president. He went from the cool Barry to someone who was came as close as possible to slapping Romney across the face on that one. And I don't blame him. There used to be a time in America, to go to your former, then issues like foreign affairs like this were not weren't subject to such partisan debate. Now, if you look at the Obama foreign policy writ large, you've seen a lot of successes. You see this is a messy, difficult thing, and I think people see it that way. I think the State Department was in the fog for a while about what was happening for real. But it's what is out there to get picked on, and it's going to get picked on for the next couple of days. But I think it's storm and fury signifying nothing.
Let me see what looks like Carlos from Marlton has to say. And Carlos, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning. The basic point is simply this. To me, this is all about the economy, because many of the issues that we're discussing today are minuscule when we have a situation where an economy is working. And even though the plan provided by Romney, which I supported Obama in the last 4 years, was broad, at least I see a plan. Whether it's broad and it needs to be refined, at least there is a conceptual idea of where things need to go. And to me, all of these issues go away in the media, in the newspapers, in the radio, the small issues, when individuals are working, when individuals are in a position that they have the necessary income to pay for their bills on a monthly basis.
Let me toss that to you, Ben Berger. Does it, in the final analysis, does it come down to the economy and jobs?
It so often has, the Clinton line of it being the economy stupid. So the interesting thing is that the post-debate polls from CBS and CNN both had Obama as a narrow winner. A bunch of people thinking that it was a draw, but he was the narrow, had a plurality. But on economic issues, people voted Romney, who would have been more decisive and better. And it's possible, conceivable, that Obama may have won the battle then, but lost the overall war if it turns out indeed that people vote with their pocketbooks in the economy.
Do you think it is the economy in the final analysis?
Well, I agree with your caller in this way. I think that the president has not laid out his vision for the next 4 years. He didn't do it on his acceptance speech. He didn't do it the first debate. He hasn't done it on the second debate. Romney, we can criticize his plan, but the president really hasn't come forward and said, here's what I want to do. Here are the five steps, for instance. I have my own five-point plan, and here's what I want to do. And I think people are hungry for that. I don't think they want a situation where, I think sometimes you can interpret it, the president says, things are getting better, and let's hope they continue to get better. It looks like they should. That's not a plan. That's a hope. And I don't think that evinces leadership.
And that's Tom Farrick, who joins us along with Ben Berger. And we're talking about last night's presidential debate. And I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me get that. Looks like Mary from Ole to join us. And Mary, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. That would be number seven. Yes, go ahead, Mary. Hi, Mary, go ahead.
I watched both presidential debates and the vice presidential debate, and I noticed a certain amount of disrespect during both debates, especially from Mr. Romney toward both the moderator in both debates and the president. I think it seemed to work for him as the aggressor, especially in the first debate, and Joe Biden used the same sort of tactic to interrupt Mr. Ryan, so I feel like Romney tried it again last night, but it's one thing to try to defend your position However, both times I thought he came across as a little rude. And I'm wondering, has our society just gotten so used to this that we're just taking it? I mean, shouldn't there be a respect for the presidency and the moderator in a forum like that? Thank you. I'll take my comments off the air.
Mary, thanks for calling into Radio Times. A decline of deference, Tom?
Well, I could see where it wasn't Jerry Springer, but on the other hand, where people get paid to yell. They get paid to yell at each other. I'm not quite sure.
They do something, but they certainly are yelling at
each other. But I think that was deliberate on the part of Romney. I think he wanted to challenge the president. He certainly succeeded in doing it in the first debate. He wanted to come out swinging, to use that metaphor again. And you're right. I know that that people fighting each other on stage like this, politicians, turned some people off. But that clearly was a deliberate decision on part of his campaign to come out swinging.
And certainly President Obama, after his lackluster, they say, first performance or first debate, had to come out doing his version of swinging as well,
sure.
Ben.
Sure. You know, one of the things that makes this hard to answer is that there's just not a very long history of presidential debates. 1960 is the first one. People talk about Lincoln Douglas, but that was for Illinois Senate, not for a president. Mm-hmm. And so then after 60, it was 1976, I think, is the next one after that. So there's not a long history of it. We can't go way back and then judge it long historical record. But politics has been really messy and quite rude for a very long time, really since the beginning of the Republic and before that. So actually, it just wasn't televised. Mm-hmm. But a lot of speeches, you know, there were tables in the Senate that were a certain distance apart so people couldn't hit each other with their canes on the Senate floor. So I wouldn't make too much about this being a new era of incivility.
We're almost out of time here, but would you say, Ben Berger, that debates are good for democracy, even if they're messy? And
especially if they're messy. I think a little too much tidiness would be a negative thing because politics is messy and society is messy. They're good for democracy if people watch and watch critically.
On that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Ben Berger, Associate Professor of Political Science at Swarthmore College, wrote a book called Attention Deficit Democracy. Thank you, Ben, for joining us.
Pleasure.
Tom Farrick, thank you for joining us as well, Tom. And he is senior editor of Metropolis, and that's a local news and information site based here in Philadelphia. Longtime worked at the Philadelphia Inquirer as a reporter, editor, and columnist. We appreciate those phone calls to Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.